welcome to the latest talk in my series, Questions About Anne Boleyn. I do apologise for not having done one for a while, but I'm getting back to it now. And I'd actually like to give a shout out today to Riley, who is Kathy's granddaughter, Kathy being one of my YouTube followers here. And Riley really enjoys my Boleyn videos, so apparently it would make her day if I gave a shout out to her. So hi, Riley. Thank you for joining. Now, in my last Questions About Anne Boleyn video, I corrected a myth. The myth that Anne Boleyn stole her sister Mary Boleyn's son, Henry Carey, and that she adopted him without Mary's permission or approval. Now, it's just not true, as I explained in that talk. But some people believe it because it was part of the story in a best-selling historical novel by Philippa Gregory. I'm sure you've heard of it, The Other Boleyn Girl. And this novel, as well as being a best-selling novel, it's been adapted for TV and for the big screen as well. So it's been enjoyed by lots and lots of people worldwide. Now, when I published that talk, I received lots of messages asking if I'd consider talking about The Other Boleyn Girl a bit more and pointing out where Philippa Gregory has deviated from the real story, has deviated from history. Now, my purpose in doing this talk is not to provoke any anti-Philippa Gregory sentiment. I really don't want to do that. Philippa Gregory is a historical novelist. This talk is purely about pointing out the inaccuracies or the storylines that don't fit the facts. You know, just pointing out, where it's been inaccurate. Now, obviously, with historical fiction, the onus is on the reader to take things with a pinch of salt, sometimes a very hefty pinch of salt, and to realise that the book that they're reading or the film they're watching or the TV series they're enjoying is fiction inspired by real historical events and real people, rather than a true retelling of what happened. Because sometimes we don't know exactly what happened. We don't know the person's feelings. And sometimes there are these blanks in history that a novelist will attempt to fill in to tell a story. But some readers don't take these things with a pinch of salt, or they don't sort of, go on and research the real story. They take things at face value. And I've even had people citing The Other Boleyn Girl to me as a source to back up their argument when I haven't quite agreed with them. And I've heard of people using it as a reference book while studying Henry VIII's reign and Anne Boleyn, using it as a shortcut, a bit like one of those study guides that you can get when you're studying a work of literature. Not a good idea. However, on the other hand, I've also heard of how The Other Boleyn Girl and books like it have brought people to Tudor history and sparked off their interest in the Boleyns, sorry, a bit of a cat fight going on behind me there, sparked off their interest in the Boleyns and King Henry VIII's reign. And that is brilliant when that happens. Okay, so let's look at some of the inaccuracies or the questionable storylines of The Other Boleyn Girl novel and also the movie, because they're actually quite different at times. And by the way, I will give links in the description of this video to other videos I've done where I've done a longer talk on a specific topic that is, you know, does come up in Philippa Gregory's work, just so that you can get deeper into that. And I share my sources, the evidence. So I will give you links to those. In the novel, The Other Boleyn Girl, we have Mary Boleyn really as the main character. Now, she's portrayed as really a wide-eyed innocent, who she's a virgin when she marries her first husband, William Carey. And then she's desperately worried when King Henry VIII is interested in her and wants to take her as his mistress. She's desperately worried about actually sleeping with King Henry VIII because of her lack of sexual experience. But that's when her sister, Anne Boleyn, can help her. Anne Boleyn assures their father and their uncle that she will coach Mary well enough to get her into his bed. So we have Mary as the innocent, the sort of the angel, and we have Anne as the kind of the vamp who's got sexual experience and can help out her sister. Now, in reality, there's no evidence that Anne had any sexual experience before she began cohabiting with King Henry VIII in late 1532. And it's Mary Boleyn who is historically surrounded by scandal. Rodolfo Pio, Bishop of Faenza, claimed that the French king, Francis I, knew Mary. And when he says knew, he means in the biblical sense of the word, in a sexual way, that he knew her as a great prostitute and infamous above all. That's a translation of what he said, i.e. that she'd been a mistress of King Francis I. Now, this claim is something I go into in detail in my talk, Mary Boleyn, Mistress of Two Kings. So you can see that and see whether Mary was actually, whether how much evidence there is for Mary actually having been Francis I's mistress. So I go into detail in that. So it's Mary that's historically got that kind of scandal surrounding her, and there's no evidence that Anne Boleyn could coach Mary in this way. Then in the novel, we have Anne Boleyn, this vampish Anne Boleyn, setting out to trap Henry Percy. Henry Percy being the son and heir in the novel of the Duke of Northumberland. And she wants to trap him so that she can be a wealthy duchess one day. Anne tells her sister Mary, "I'm going to make him marry me." And Mary watches Anne with Percy and comments, "I saw how she played him." It's not a romance. It's not about love. The relationship between Anne and Percy on Anne's side is all about ambition and her greed. She wants to rise higher than she is at the moment. She wants that status, that money. Percy falls for Anne and the couple become betrothed. Then they consummate the betrothal to make it legal. And in fact, that would make it in those days a valid marriage. Cardinal Thomas Wolsey finds out, steps in and puts an end to the relationship. And Elizabeth Boleyn, Anne and Mary's mother, makes Mary forge a letter from Anne to Percy saying that she has to give him up. Great storyline. But is any of that based on actual history? Well, in real life, Anne Boleyn, who was serving Queen Catherine of Aragon, did indeed meet Henry Percy. Now, Henry Percy was son and heir of the Earl of Northumberland, not Duke. So Anne was never going to be a duchess. She was going to be a countess. So just a little inaccuracy there. So she meets him at court when she's serving Catherine of Aragon, and he's in the household of Cardinal Wolsey, and the two of them become romantically involved. However, there's nothing to suggest that Anne sets out to trap Percy in any way. It appears that they simply fell in love and that they intended to marry. George Cavendish, Cardinal Wolsey's gentleman usher, recorded that Percy would then resort for his pastime unto the Queen's chamber, and there would fall in dalliance among the Queen's ladies, being at the last more conversant with Mistress Anne Boleyn than with any other. It was then that there grew such a secret love between them that at length they were ensured together, intending to marry. So this was just a romance between two courtiers. They just fell in love. Now, regarding the idea that they were betrothed in any way, we do know that Mary Talbot, Percy's wife, he went on to marry her when Cardinal Wolsey And the Earl of Northumberland sort of broke up his relationship with Anne Boleyn because he was supposed to marry Mary Talbot. He went on to marry Mary Talbot. And Mary claimed in 1532 that her marriage to Percy was invalid because he'd previously been pre-contracted to marry Anne Boleyn, who was at that stage involved with the king. Henry Percy denied this pre-contract. He swore an oath on the Blessed Sacrament. So he swore an oath on the Eucharist, which was a major thing to do. He was putting his soul into mortal danger there, so he would have believed if he told a lie. And he did this in front of the Duke of Norfolk, the archbishops, and the king's canon lawyers. So that was a major thing to do. And Anne Boleyn also denied this pre-contract. Percy denied it once again in May 1536, when, of course, Anne had fallen and was imprisoned in the Tower of London. Thomas Cromwell had decided to try and resurrect the issue of the pre-contract in an effort to get Anne Boleyn's marriage to King Henry VIII annulled. Percy was forced to deny it once again in frustration. He was very exasperated that it was being brought up again, but he denied it once again. And there is no evidence that Anne and Percy slept together either. In The Other Boleyn Girl, Mary and Anne Boleyn are depicted as pawns of their ambitious parents and uncle. Thomas and Elizabeth Boleyn used to be Elizabeth Howard, along with Elizabeth's brother Thomas Howard, Duke of Norfolk, have these kind of regular family conferences, sort of meetings where they plot and scheme to use their girls, Mary and Anne, to raise the family status, to rise in favour with King Henry VIII. And this is something that comes up all the time on social media, and people are trying to rehabilitate the girl's reputation. It's always, you know, Thomas Boleyn's fault, the Boleyn family's fault, you know, acting as pimps. There's just this prevalent idea that Thomas Boleyn used his daughters for his own gain and that he acted as a pimp. It's a very, very popular idea. Every time I write about him or mention him in a video, I receive comments, you know, about that, about what a monster he was. However, this idea just isn't backed up by history whatsoever. Thomas was certainly ambitious, like everybody else at court, but he was already a favourite. He was already on the rise before either of his daughters became involved with the king. He'd started his rise at court in the reign of King Henry VII and just carried on in the reign of King Henry VIII. He had no need whatsoever to pimp his daughters to the king. And there is no evidence that he, his wife, or the Duke of Norfolk had anything to do with Mary or Anne's relationships with Henry VIII. On the contrary, it can actually be argued that Thomas Boleyn was unhappy about his daughters' relationships with the king. The fact that King Henry VIII had to intercede and ask Thomas to provide for Mary after the death of her first husband, William Carey, from sweating sickness, might suggest that there was some kind of breakdown in the family, that the Boleyns had perhaps distanced themselves from Mary because of her reputation and what had happened with the king. We just don't know. But there certainly wasn't that closeness there. And regarding Anne, evidence suggests that Thomas Boleyn was initially against Henry VIII's plans to marry Anne. So that doesn't go with Thomas Boleyn shoving his daughter at the king. Eustace Chapuis, the imperial ambassador, wrote that, "I must add that the said Earl of Wiltshire," that's Thomas Boleyn, "has never declared himself up to this moment. On the contrary, he has hitherto, as the Duke of Norfolk has frequently told me, tried to dissuade the king rather than otherwise from the marriage." So that's an interesting comment. Chapuis is being told that Thomas Boleyn is sort of doubting the king's plans for marrying Anne. Now, why would Thomas be described in this way? if actually he's wanting to use his daughter's status as queen for his own benefit. It doesn't make sense, but I'll give you a link to read an article I wrote in defense of Thomas Boleyn, so you can read a bit more about this. Moving on. In the other Boleyn girl novel, Anne Boleyn is ordered by her family to flirt with the king while her sister, Mary Boleyn, is pregnant. Mary is carrying the king's child, and the Boleyns and their uncle, well, the Boleyns and Elizabeth's brother, the Duke of Norfolk, are very concerned that, you know, while Mary is pregnant and can't sleep with the king and keep him happy, that the king might turn to someone else. He might take another mistress and they'll lose their status and their power. Elizabeth Boleyn says to Mary, "Thank God Anne has him in her toils. She plays with him like you might tease the queen's dog. She has him on a thread." And then Anne tells her sister that she is going to hold out till he sees that he has to make me an offer, a very great offer. And this suggests, obviously, that the family have got Anne to do this, and that Anne has set out to trap and manipulate Henry VIII on her family's orders, and that she holds out on him sexually as part of her ambitious plan to become his queen. Now, as I've said, there is no evidence that Anne's family ordered Anne to throw herself at the king in any way. And there's also no evidence that Anne herself set out to trap the king, to dangle her virginity as bait. We know very little about the beginning of Henry and Anne's courtship. But what we do know from evidence like Henry's love letters to Anne is that when the king started pursuing her, when he noticed her, when she was a lady-in-waiting to his wife Catherine, and he noticed her and fell for her, that Anne left court. She retreated to the family home, Hever Castle in Kent. We know from his letters that she didn't reply to his love letters. She left them unanswered. Now, I've heard people suggest that this was all part of her game, that she was playing hard to get, and she knew that this would make the king crazy and even more excited and determined to have her. But how could Anne Boleyn know that? Surely it's more likely that with her saying no, that he'd move on to an easier conquest. There is no way on earth that Anne Boleyn could predict that her actions would lead to the king offering her marriage. There was no precedent for that. So I'm sorry, but that's a totally ridiculous idea that she played this game. See my video, "Was Anne Boleyn a Homewrecker?" for more on that. In the other Boleyn girl, Mary Boleyn's children are both fathered by King Henry VIII. Now, we don't know when Mary slept with the king, when their relationship happened. In fact, we don't even know that there was a relationship, only that they had sex at least once, enough to cause an impediment of affinity that Henry then sought a dispensation for when he wanted to marry Anne. He'd had a sexual relationship with one of Anne's very close family members, and he needed a dispensation to get over that impediment. It would have been seen as a kind of incestuous union otherwise. Now, historians and authors often date the start of Henry's affair with Mary Boleyn to Shrovetide 1522, when the king rode out with a motto, "El mon coeur a navera," or "She has wounded my heart," embroidered on the trappings of his horse. But there's no evidence at all that this was aimed at Mary. He didn't say, "Mary has wounded my heart." It could have been just a theme, chivalric, romantic theme for the Shrovetide celebrations of that year. Or it could have been aimed at another lady that the king was interested in. It is such a leap to suggest that this was aimed at Mary Boleyn and that this is when their relationship started. I don't understand why people are so ready to grab onto that as evidence, because it certainly isn't evidence. We look for corroboration and no, there isn't any. If the king's relationship with Mary Boleyn was like his one with Elizabeth Blunt, Bessie Blunt, then the king married Mary off to William Carey after he had finished sleeping with her. And Mary married William Carey in February 1520. It's sort of a case of, I finished with you now, but look, here's a good marriage match for you. You know, compensation. In the novel, Mary and the king have a rather long and loving relationship. They both seem very much in love. And Mary is depicted as being his true love. And this is often seen in novels. It's even sort of mentioned in history books that somehow Mary Boleyn is the king's true love. And in the film, the bells are ringing out for their true love here. And in the film, we see Mary using her past relationship with the king to try and save her brother and sister in May 1536. Sorry, the bells are still, they're ringing out for Anne and George now. But there is no evidence of any of that. Mary and Henry's relationship might just have consisted of one night. We know nothing about it, absolutely nothing about it, only that it happened. We don't know also where Mary was in 1536, but there is absolutely no evidence that she went to Henry and tried to do something about what was happening. There's no evidence that the king was truly in love with Mary and that Mary was in love with him. Then we have some authors and historians using the rewards granted to William Carey to prove that the king was compensating him for the use of his wife and for William Carey bringing up the king's children as his own. But William Carey was related to the king. He was a favourite and he served him in his privy chamber. So, like other favourites and loyal servants, such as Henry Norris, the king's groom of the stool, for example, he was given grants to reward him for his service. If we say that William Carey was being compensated with these rewards for the use of his wife or for bringing up the king's children, then what about Henry Norris? And what about a whole other long list of men that were kind of that standing, that were rewarded with grants, offices and titles and manors and leases and such like? Was the king also compensating them? You just can't use those things to back up an idea like that. It is a leap. As for Anne Boleyn stealing Mary's son, I mentioned that at the start of the talk. You know, the idea that Anne Boleyn goes off with, well, takes Henry Carey as part of her plan to marry the king. That's a load of poppycock. I'll give you a link to my video on that. In reality, Anne was granted the wardship of two-year-old Henry Carey after his father's death in 1528. She didn't adopt him. She didn't steal him. She didn't take him without Mary's permission. This was actually a way of helping her sister, easing her sister's financial burden. Anne was responsible for little Henry's education. And it was standard practice at the time for a monarch to grant wardships to influential nobles and courtiers. It was seen as advantageous. Having your child placed in a more influential home helped them up the ladder of success. And Anne helped Henry Carey by arranging for him to be tutored by French reformer and scholar Nicolas Bourbon, something that Mary just couldn't have been able to afford or arrange herself. So Anne was helping Mary. It wasn't something that was horrible. It was something that was good. Then we have Philippa Gregory's depiction of George Boleyn. George, of course, being the brother of Anne and Mary. In the novel, it's actually quite disturbing, I feel anyway. He has unnatural relationships with both of his sisters. He says to Mary, "Kiss me again. Kiss me like you kiss Henry." You know, in other words, like you kissed your lover, the king. And then we have him kissing Anne in a way that really you'd only kiss a lover. It's not in a brotherly, sisterly way. He leaned forward and kissed her again. Her eyes closed and her lips smiled and then parted. His finger went to her bare shoulder and stroked her neck. His finger went into her smooth, dark hair and pulled her head back for his kiss. I'm just cringing as I read that. It's just like, ew, not brotherly and sisterly at all. Then we have Anne Boleyn, who is vampish, I feel, taunting George. "Don't you want to touch me? Wouldn't you rather take me to your chamber?" It's just, ew, again. And then, of course, we have Anne and George actually committing incest and Anne getting pregnant by her brother. Anne says to Mary of her third pregnancy, "No one knows what went into the making of this baby, Mary. No one will ever know." And she also says, "For I went on a journey to the very gates of hell to get him. You will never know." And then Mary sees a guilty look on George's face and she concludes, "Anne had taken him as her companion on her journey to the gates of hell to conceive this child for England." And it's all rather horrible. It's just such a horrible kind of theme. Now, although at their trials in May 1536, Anne and George were found guilty of committing incest, the only evidence produced to back up this charge, according to Eustace Chapuis, the imperial ambassador, who actually didn't have much time for Anne or George Boleyn, didn't like them. He said that the only evidence produced was that he had been once found a long time with her. So the only evidence was that George and Anne had once spent a long time with each other. Ridiculous. George, at his trial, defended himself so well against this charge against him that, according to Chapuis, several of those present wagered 10 to 1 that he would be acquitted, especially as no witnesses were produced against either him or her. So no evidence and no witnesses. Now in the Q&A section of The Other Boleyn Girl, I'm not sure whether this appears in all copies of it, but it's in my copy of it. Q&A session, you know, all for answering questions at the end. Philippa Gregory states, "I think if she had thought that Henry could not bear a son, she was quite capable of finding someone to father a child on her. If she thought that, then George would have been the obvious choice." Now, to me, that makes no sense whatsoever. If Henry was having trouble with something like erectile dysfunction, which is suggested by what came out at George's trial, something that Anne confided in George's wife, Jane, about, then I don't feel that it would have been at all sensible for Anne to get pregnant by someone else. If Henry wasn't able to do the deed with Anne, then it would be fairly obvious that if Anne got pregnant, that her child had been fathered by another man. Statement of the obvious there. And I don't know about you, that if I was having trouble getting pregnant by my husband, then my brother is not the first solution. He's not the obvious choice. My brother does not spring to mind as being someone that can help me out with that. And we're talking about people with strong religious convictions and faith here. They would have seen incest as abhorrent. So I just do face palms and headbangs at all of that. Now, of course, in The Other Bling Girl, a deformed fetus, what's described as a baby horridly malformed with a spine flayed open and a huge head twice as large as the spindly little body, is the result of this incest, this relationship, this unnatural relationship between George and Anne. And Anne miscarries this monster in 1536. Now, if you've heard my talk and watched the video on this topic, the deformed fetus, you'll know that it is not mentioned by any contemporary source. The idea that there was anything wrong or different about Anne's miscarriage in January 1536 is only mentioned by Nicholas Sander, a Catholic recusant, a Catholic who was in exile, writing in the 1580s in Elizabeth I's reign. He is also the one that describes Anne Boleyn as having an extra finger, large wen and a projecting tooth, and all other kinds of myths and inaccuracies appear in his work. He was writing anti-Protestant, anti-Elizabeth I propaganda. He had an agenda. He was blackening Elizabeth's name and the names of her parents as well, who he held responsible for the Protestant Reformation. He wasn't at court in 1536. He was a young child at the time. So it's not evidence we can rely on. It isn't evidence. And of course, in the novel, Anne's miscarriage is caused by Anne taking a potion to get rid of the baby that has died in her womb. William Stafford, Mary's second husband, says to his wife that Anne is certainly guilty of dabbling in witchcraft. And we also find out that the midwife who is present when Anne miscarries this monstrous baby has actually been employed by King Henry VIII as a witch taker to watch Anne. Now, contrary to myth and contrary to all the comments and that come out in May each year, when it's always said that Anne was charged with witchcraft in May 1536, Anne wasn't charged with witchcraft. It's not mentioned in the indictments of charges against her. It is not mentioned in the trial. She's not accused of it by those around her. And as I said, there's no evidence that Anne miscarried a monster or that she took a potion, that she did anything to bring on this miscarriage. So we can throw that one out of the window. Then going back to her brother, George. In The Other Bling Girl, George is, he's bisexual, I think. And in other works of fiction and in some books, he's gay. But we have this bisexual George who is unnaturally attracted to his sisters, but who's also interested in men. Now, it was historian Reatha Warnick who put forward the idea that the men who were executed for adultery with Anne Boleyn in 1536 were what she calls libertines who committed sodomy, something that was seen as sinful at that time. And in The Other Bling Girl, George, you know, he acts inappropriately with his sisters, but he also has a sexual relationship with courtier Sir Francis Weston, Sir Francis Weston being one of those who is executed in May 1536. He tells his sisters that a boy is so clean and so clear, and then announces, "I'm in love with a man." Later in the novel, Mary Boleyn knocks on George's locked door, and when George opens it, Sir Francis Weston is straightening his doublet, suggesting that the two men have been enjoying a sort of romantic liaison. However, there's no evidence that George or any of the men executed in 1536 were anything other than heterosexual. There's just no evidence to back up that idea. Some authors have used the fact that these men confessed to being sinners in their execution speeches as evidence that they were having homosexual relationships with each other. And also the idea that Weston mentions in his speech, living in abomination. But scaffold speeches were like that. Their scaffold speeches fit all the kind of, there was a model for an execution speech. Scaffold speeches were choreographed in a way, and everyone kind of followed the same recipe. Tudor people believed in original sin. They believed that everybody deserved to die, and that whether or not they were guilty of the actual charges against them, they deserved to die because of the other stuff that they'd done in their lives and because of original sin, because they were sinners. It is such a leap again, and it's reading too much into their execution speeches to make out that these men believed they should die because they were homosexual, something that was seen as sinful at the time. And in The Other Boleyn Girl, this gay George Boleyn, or bisexual George Boleyn, also despises his wife Jane, really hates her, and that's something that also comes up in things like the Tudors as well. And Jane, you know, living with a man that hates her, she then takes revenge for his treatment of her by bringing him and Anne down. You know, she's jealous of them, of their relationship, and she betrays them and she gives evidence against them. The Jane Boleyn of the book and the film is jealous, spiteful, and light-fingered. She's someone that likes to sort of peep through keyholes and watch people. She's a nasty piece of work, really unlikable, horrible. And Philippa Gregory notes that the strongest evidence against George was a statement written by Jane Parker, the wife he had always despised. Now that's Philippa Gregory talking about the real history behind it. That's what she, you know, is saying about, you know, she's explaining her depiction of Jane. But that's just not true. We know from contemporary sources that no witnesses were produced at the trial, and there's no mention of Jane providing evidence of incest against George and Anne. Chroniclers and ambassadors would surely have mentioned it if George's own wife had turned against her husband and the Queen and helped to bring them down. The only mentions of George's wife in May 1536 of Jane sending George a message of comfort after his arrest and imprisonment in the Tower, and of her telling the Crown that Anne had spoken to her of the King's sexual problems, and then her passing this information on to George. That is evidence of a close relationship between Anne, Jane, and George. You know, Anne confiding in Jane and then Jane confiding in George, rather than one of hatred, bitterness, and jealousy. And it's not a statement given by someone to looking to bring down her husband and his sister for incest. So Jane has been used as a bit of a scapegoat. She's been maligned unfairly. She's the treatment of her in The Other Boleyn Girl and the other book by Philippa Gregory about Jane. It's just unfair in my view. And I'd recommend Julia Fox's meticulously researched biography of her, which successfully challenges the myths that have built up around this Tudor lady. It's a fantastic book, and the notes and references are brilliant. You can see how Julia has come to the conclusions that she has. In The Other Boleyn Girl, Anne is horrified when she gives birth to Elizabeth, a daughter, in 1533, because Elizabeth is just a girl. Anne also is lacking in maternal love. There is no relationship at all between her and her daughter because her daughter is such a disappointment to her. And there is an awful scene where Anne strips little Elizabeth half naked to prove to everyone that Elizabeth is perfect and beautiful, that there's nothing wrong with her. Elizabeth's lip is trembling as Anne rages at Henry, and it's just such a horrible scene. Now, while Anne and Henry may have been shocked and momentarily disappointed when Anne gave birth to a daughter, because they'd been told by physicians, astrologers, by everyone that Anne was expecting a son, that she was carrying their Prince of Wales, they quickly got over it and a lavish christening was planned. And Anne seems to have sort of gloried in her daughter. She didn't strip off her daughter like that. Evidence points to Anne loving her daughter dearly and taking great interest in her upbringing. We have lists of things that Anne bought for her daughter and for her daughter's nursery and household. And she wanted to know about, her daughter's life in her separate household. Royal babies were always brought up in a separate household. Anne wanted to know about her daughter being weaned. She sent instructions to Lady Bryan. She was as involved as a queen possibly could be. And just a few days before her arrest, Anne met with her chaplain, Matthew Parker, and made him promise something, we don't know what, but promised something that stayed with him for life. Something that made him accept the office of Archbishop of Canterbury when Elizabeth I wanted him in that position, even though he had just had an accident and didn't want the job because he didn't feel fit. He was ill and he didn't feel he was right for it and he just didn't want it. But we know from letters he wrote that he felt compelled to take this because of something he'd promised the Queen's mother, because of something he promised Anne Boleyn just a few days before she was arrested. We don't know what Anne said to him, but I'm convinced that she asked him to help and support her daughter in any way that he could. Anne did something for Elizabeth. And I just can't see there being any evidence of there being some kind of breach in their relationship and not having maternal love. Anne comes across as this rather spiteful, ambitious woman who will stop at nothing to have the crown. But not only that, she's a murderess as well, according to Philippa Gregory. In the Q&A section of the book, Gregory says that Anne was not a woman to let something like sin or crime stand in her way. She was guilty of one murder. Now, here I can only assume that Gregory is referring to the attempted poisoning of Bishop Fisher's household by his cook Richard Roos in 1531. All who ate the poisoned food on that day became ill, and two poor people who were given leftovers actually died as a result of it. Fisher survived, fortunately, and it's not clear what exactly happened, but Roos claimed that he'd put purgatives in the food as a jest, as a joke, and that he'd not meant to harm anyone at all. But Henry VIII persuaded Parliament to pass a bill, the Act for Poisoning, which attainted Roos of high treason and made it high treason to kill anyone by poison. Eustace Chapuis, the imperial ambassador, believe that Henry VIII became personally involved in this case and wanted Roos dealt with in such a brutal way. To avert suspicion from falling, if not on himself, for he is too noble-minded to have resource to such means, at least on the lady and her father. So that is suggesting, Chapuis is suggesting that the king had to act because he didn't want suspicion to fall on Anne Boleyn, the lady, and her father, Thomas Boleyn, her family. Because, of course, Bishop Fisher was, a staunch supporter of Catherine of Aragon during the great matter, Henry's quest for an annulment. However, there's no evidence that the king or the Boleyns were involved in any way in this poisoning. And Roos did not implicate anybody else either. He went to his death, a nasty death, by being boiled alive, naming no names and just claiming that it was all a bad accident. It was a jest. In the other Boleyn girl, Mary Boleyn's daughter, Catherine Carey, becomes a maid of honour to Queen Anne Boleyn. In reality, there's no evidence of Catherine serving Anne. And the first time that Catherine is mentioned as a maid of honour at the royal court is when she is appointed in 1539 to serve Anne of Cleves, who is on her way to England to marry Henry VIII as his fourth wife, something that she does on Epiphany, the Feast of the Epiphany, January the 6th, 1540. And Catherine serves her as maid of honour. So that is also an inaccuracy. In the novel, Mary Boleyn also gives birth to a third child, a daughter fathered by her second husband, William Stafford, in 1535. And they call this daughter Anne, after Mary's sister. Now, although we do know that Mary turned up at court pregnant in September 1534, when she announces to the Queen, Queen Anne Boleyn, that she's secretly married William Stafford, we don't actually know what happened to that pregnancy. Mary was visibly pregnant at this point, but we don't know what happened to that baby. We don't even know if Mary carried the baby to term. No child is mentioned in any records. So we don't know whether Mary lost the baby before it was full term, whether she had a stillbirth, whether the baby died, you know, shortly after birth. We don't know. But there is no evidence that she had a daughter called Anne. There are just no records about that baby at all. Finally, in the film, we see Mary, played by Scarlett Johansson, taking Henry VIII's and Anne's daughter Elizabeth, the future Elizabeth I, away from court at the end. She's sort of rescuing Elizabeth from what's going on. That, of course, never happened. Elizabeth, at the time, was away from court in her own household. And there's no evidence of her seeing Mary at this time, never mind going off into the sunset with her. So, sorry, folks, that's an inaccuracy as well. Now, it's been a while since I've read the book. I've just been going on my notes here and my memory, and it's been a while since I watched the movie as well. So I'm sure there must be something I've missed. I'm sure you can think of other inaccuracies. So please do mention them in the comments, and do feel free as well to ask questions about the book, the film, and about the real history. You are welcome to do that, and I will try and answer them if I can. So thank you for joining me for this installment of my questions about Sir Anne Boleyn series. And please don't think that I'm trying to have a go at Philippa Gregory in any way. I have enjoyed lots of her books. I just find The Other Boleyn Girl rather frustrating, especially the Q&A section at the back. And I do get frustrated by the way that it has led to lots of misunderstandings. But we need to treat it as a novel, as fiction. We need to do our own due diligence at finding out the real truth of the story. And I hope that's what I'm doing. Thank you for listening to this podcast. I do hope you enjoyed it. And don't forget to subscribe so that you can enjoy podcasts on a daily basis. Thank you.